We're going to get started. I'm going to call the Public Safety Policy and Oversight Committee to order. Today is March 9th. We do have a quorum. We're going to get started. Call to order the Public Safety Policy and Oversight Committee. Today is March 9th. Representative Bigham. Representative Bigham would like to move that House File 3106 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations Reform. Members, this is the DWI bill that we've already had a lengthy hearing on. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead. Keep in mind that we have already heard this bill, and we do have a couple of amendments that will be offered, but if you could keep your testimony,
please. Madam Chair, thank you very much. Michael Camp is my name. I'm Commissioner of Public Safety. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to be here. I'll be very brief. I was asked to make just a couple of overlaying comments. I only want to leave the committee and Madam Chair with two thoughts. It starts off by the fact that this body on two occasions in the last 3 years has voted once to implement a pilot project for ignition interlock and last legislative session to continue that pilot project for an ignition lock program, not just in two counties as previously was decided, but statewide. As members go through the process of hearing hearings on this bill, there's two thoughts that I think are important that I would ask members to keep in front of them. First and foremost, this bill is a public safety, highway traffic safety bill. If you envision, if you will, that some 37,000 people a year get arrested for DWI offenses in Minnesota, and again, the data that's been extracted from the pilot project in Hennepin County, their estimates are after 2 years that probably roughly half the people that would get arrested for a DWI would take advantage of ignition interlock. If you extrapolate that out statewide, after a year of this, the implementation of a bill similar to what's in front of you, we would have a situation where there would be literally 10 to 15,000 cars in the state of Minnesota that would not be able to be driven by a drunken driver. And those cars would be identified by the fact that their drivers had a proclivity to drive already drunk because they were arrested with it for a DWI. So to take 15,000 cars off of the highways of Minnesota being operated by a drunken driver has a very significant public safety and traffic safety impact in the state of Minnesota. So I would ask members not to lose sight of that particular goal. Second, the people that have been involved in the genesis of this bill, I think, feel very strongly that there's a very compassionate side to this bill. In the past, if you received a DWI, you would literally not be able to drive for a six-month period of time or up to a year, depending on the enhancements and the particular situation that people find themselves in. You have absolutely no recourse but to not drive a vehicle. Now, that takes you out of the job market. It takes out of the society in the sense of doing the kinds of things that we do every day in a vehicle. This legislation provides those people who receive a DWI and multiple DWIs after that to connect with an interlock technology and to continue driving their vehicle legally and not intoxicated, I wouldn't say immediately, but in a very, very short period of time. It is an avenue to legal driving. I believe that most offenders, if given the choice, would prefer to be legal and not drive illegally. And again, we think that this is there's a compassionate side to that. And Madam Chair, lastly, if you keep in mind the fact that some people say that a DWI may cost $5,000, $10,000. Some people say it might cost $20,000 over a year with insurance costs and so forth and so on. So the impact of $50 or $100 a month versus a DWI reinstatement fee of $680, maybe driving after a non-legal license traffic citation might be $300, court costs, insurance costs, those costs, Madam Chair, members, pale by comparison of the $100 or $50 it would cost to connect the ignition interlock. So the cost, if it was weighed side by side, I think there is a tremendous advantage of ignition interlock, and ask you to consider it very seriously. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Next, I would have the Director of Traffic Safety, Sherry Marty.
Here. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and please be brief.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Member. My name is Cherie Marty. I'm the Director of the Office of Traffic Safety with the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. And you've already heard the key merits of our DWI bill, and I just want to run briefly through the four cornerstones, very brief. First of all, we are requiring that all DWI offenders drive a vehicle with the ignition interlock system or sit out their revocation and not drive. Secondly, that we are looking for our DWI's first-time offenders to be enhanced at 0.15 blood alcohol content rather than the current blood alcohol concentration of 0.20. Third, we are looking at restructuring reinstatement requirements for our chronic, repeat, high-risk DWI offenders. And finally, our bill really does capitalize on the lessons learned from our statewide ignition interlock program 3 years ago. The legislature did pass this program for two counties. We've expanded that last year in 2009 through your approval and legislation for a statewide ignition interlock program. We currently have over 700 participants, and it's been extremely successful. So our proposal really does build from what's already working and the lessons that we're learning and expanding this further.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, one more comment from the Public Defense Board, and then we can turn to amendments if you so choose.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Steve Holmgren. I'm the Chief Public Defender in the 1st District, and I was also one of the stakeholder representatives involved with the groups who ultimately made recommendations for this bill. And I'd like to say that our agency certainly supports the idea of ignition interlock, and we are comfortable with this bill. Our concern, we do have some concerns in that it's critical to us that indigent people, not just the poor, but also the working poor, have the ability to participate in this bill, because without their participation, it really becomes, in a lot of ways, a wealthy-only program. And to be effective, we think it needs to be widespread participation. I would also like to point out that we've made these concerns known to the Department of Public Safety, and they've expressed a willingness to work with us as far as trying to fashion some sort of indigent standards. As the bill is now, it directs the commissioner to establish them, and I think it's important for everybody to know that we're willing to work with the Department of Public Safety and hopefully come up with some sort of a standard that works for everybody.
Thank you. Representative Bingham, any further testifiers?
None that I know of, Madam Speaker.
Okay. Representative Druskowski, I believe you have the A9 amendment. Representative Druskowski.
I do, Madam Chair. Actually, I hadn't seen this until now. I would like to, if I could, hold off maybe till a future committee and perfect the language, Madam Chair.
Representative Druskowski, why don't you tell us what you're intending on doing, because public safety policy issues should be dealt with in public safety policy, but I'm happy to let it continue to move and you continue to work with the author as long as we know what it is your intention is.
We'll do, Madam Chair. Thank you. The A2 amendment, members, relates to and is...
Is
intended to relate to, and I had discussions with the department this morning about those chronic offenders who offend, and maybe potentially on ignition interlock for periods of 4 or 5 years, and who are people who say, well, I'm not going to be on ignition interlock because I don't have a car, those types of things. And so we're looking for some sort of fix. We did last time remove the B card from here, but the question is, what about these folks who say, well, I don't have a car, so they're really only subject at that point to the revocation provisions that would be in law. What do we do in that case? And so this language is an attempt to address that, and I would actually like it more fine-tuned and limited to those people who are chronic offenders who do not actively engage in the ignition interlock program.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Druskowski withdraws the A9 amendment. Representative Coles, you have the A11 amendment.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd move the A11 amendment.
Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, this is just as I was reading through the bill when Representative Bigham was initially presenting it, I raised this issue, a little bit of concern about how the language was drafted with regard to individuals who borrow a car or lease a car or obtain a car from someone else. Raised a question in committee. Maybe you shouldn't have done that, because now the Star Tribune thinks I don't like the bill at all. That's what they've said twice. But I'm looking forward to voting on the bill today, voting yes to get it out of this committee and move it forward. But I appreciate the department working on this language. I think this clears up the little concern that I had and makes the bill a little better. So I'd move the amendment.
Representative Cole moves the A11 amendment. Question from members. Representative Bigham.
The department supports the amendment.
Thank you. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Is there another? Where's this from? Oh. Representative Paymar, you have the A13 amendment. Members, do you have all been passed out? Do members have the A13 amendment? It's being passed out. Representative Paymar, do you want to describe the A13 amendment while we get it passed out?
Madam Chair, members, this amendment seeks to look at if we are going to be moving in this direction, and I understand the bill still goes.
I wasn't here. Still has finance to go to, right?
Representative Paymar, it has two more policy stops as well as finance. Yeah.
Okay.
Representative Paymar.
Well, I just wanted to get to ask the this committee to consider some other possible technologies, and I have to say I've not seen the SCRAM program, but this comes from the Waseca County, and it's this basically would allow the person who qualifies to participate in this program to petition the commissioner to be monitored by another remote alcohol monitor, which is called SCRAM. And this is, as I understand it, is a bracelet that one would wear that also can pick up whether you have alcohol levels in your body that would then disable the automobile. I think Representative Ward actually has this bill, but this answers one of my questions or one of my problems with the current bill that requires, you know, what I consider sort of collective punishment by the entire family if one person in the family were to get a DWI. So this would allow other technologies to be used besides just the ignition interlock that would be just as effective but would only really, I guess, punish, if you will, or hold accountable that offender who got the DWI.
Representative Beck.
Madam Chair, I would say it's the will of the committee, but the department would like to comment on the amendment.
Please state your name and go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, Sri Marty, Office of Traffic Safety. The comment here that the department clearly appreciates what Representative Paymar and the committee is doing to look at other technologies for monitoring of alcohol and alcohol use. Our primary and our chief concern with this amendment is that it doesn't separate the repeat high-risk offender from drinking and driving. This individual could have a monitoring device such as the SCRAM and get in their car and reoffend. That's our chief concern.
Representative Paymar.
I guess I'd like to know how, Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Jody. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Jody Oscarson, Office of Traffic Safety. The ignition interlock stops the person from driving the vehicle if they have alcohol on their breath at 0.02 or higher. If you have a SCRAM, that does not separate, and the SCRAM results do not come at least 5 days later.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Paymar.
Madam Chair, would the department consider, though, looking at other technologies? I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm just wondering if this is a one-size-fits-all for every first-time DWI offender.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, Representative Paymar, the department would consider other technologies as they evolve.
Mm-hmm.
I think, again, our chief concern is separating the drinking driver from that dangerous vehicle.
Representative Paymar, this is going to end up in your committee.
Okay, then I will withdraw it for now and work on it with the department, see if we can come up with something that fits.
That would be great. Representative okay. Paymar withdraws the A-13 amendment. Members, I will offer the A-12 amendment. Members, what this does is this takes out first-time offenders, and this committee defeated Representative Rosenthal's bill to lower double the legal limit, and so this puts the penalty or the enhancement back to where it is in current law, given the fact that we defeated that bill in this committee. So I would ask members to consider supporting the A-12 amendment. Representative Bigham.
Madam Chair, it's the will of the committee, and I would like this bill to continue on, and I will let the department respond to the amendment.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, I think we really appreciate the continued dialogue and the tremendous dialogue that we've had with this committee and with many of the individuals of this committee. Our concern about removing all first-time offenders is simply because first-time offenders is truly the lion's share of our DWI problem in Minnesota. They are 60% of the alcohol-related fatalities in Minnesota are people, many of us, who've never had a DWI. So socially drinking, going out, and actually killing and seriously injuring someone, 60%. Also, of those individuals who've never had a DWI, 40% will go on to repeat their offense. So we stand the greatest opportunity to make the biggest difference in curbing the scourge of impaired driving in Minnesota by having ignition interlock on first-time offenders.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was the question I was going to ask the department, to see what their concern was about the amendment as it stands. And if there's others in the audience that have concerns about the amendment, I'd welcome their.
Representative Coles.
Madam Chair, can you help me understand your amendment a little better? Would your amendment effectively remove an ignition interlock for first-time offenders?
Correct, Representative Coles. What it says is that ignition interlock and the proposed change for first-time offenders would not be in the bill, and it would remove the enhancement, which was part of Representative Rosenthal's bill that this committee defeated. So it would put the enhancement back at 2.0.
Madam Chair?
Or Representative Bigham.
Tad bit of clarification. If it's over 0.15, they would be eligible for the ignition lock. That's my understanding of the amendment. On a first-time offender, if it's two times the legal limit and above, it would still be eligible, the person would still be eligible for the ignition lock?
That's correct. Okay. Ms. Perius.
Madam Chair and Representative Bigham, the amendment would change it to 0.20 for first-time offenders under this amendment, and it would remove the incentives for first-time offenders to receive ignition interlock. It would reinstate the current revocation periods and the hard waiting revocation periods. So I don't believe it would prohibit someone from going on ignition interlock, but those incentives would be removed.
Questions from members? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Representative Bigham, anything else before we open it up to those in the audience?
Madam Speaker, can I ask a clarifying question of, I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Representative Bigham.
It's my birthday. I can probably.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. I was going to say I could call you whatever. I'm just kidding. Can you tell me where this bill is going again? Because it does have to make a stop in GovOps for rulemaking, and they, I believe, are hopefully going to have it scheduled on Thursday.
The motion is, Representative Bigham, to go to state and local government operations, reform elections, and technology.
Thank you for the clarification.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Hi. My name is John Cummings. I'm the founder of Minnesotans for Safe Driving. Thank you for the opportunity to say something about this. Speaking from personal experience, my son was killed by a first-time offender. and I work with a lot of offenders who have killed people, and they're first-time offenders. And there's a perception out there that this isn't a big deal until you get three or four of them. But let me tell you, this first-time offender is the biggest deal in my family's life. And we see this all the time. Everybody's got this perception of who's the problem. It's, you know, the guy with, you know, 15, 20 of them. Doesn't make any difference how many times it is. It's the one when they crash into your family, that's when it counts. So please try to dispel this notion that it first time is kind of a freebie, because it's not. It's not. And we worry about how much all this is costing the DWI offenders. You've got no idea how much this costs the victims. This cost me my business. Paid over $12,000 for Philip's funeral. You know, it's just, and it goes on and on and on. And everybody can avoid all of this stuff. All you have to do is just don't drink and drive. Real simple. So thank you for letting me say my piece. And I hope you take this seriously. Thank you.
Thank you. Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lynn Gogler, and I am the chair of public policy for Mothers Against Drunk Driving. I would also tell you that I am also a victim of a drunk driver, a first-time offender, who killed my parents the night before Thanksgiving. And as John has just said, it is a big deal. And alcohol-impaired driving takes an enormous toll, and you know the numbers, and I'm not going to bore you with them. But let me say this. For every number you get, whether it's 168 people that are killed in this state or 2,000 and some that are injured, just remember, multiply that number by the family and the friends of these folks that instantly themselves became a victim. Drinking drivers absolutely demonstrated their inability to make a decision to separate themselves from their cars. They could call a taxi, they could call a friend, but they do not do that. The National Highway Traffic Safety Association tells us that a person will drive about 87 times before they're actually caught and arrested for drink driving. Don't sympathize with a first-time offender. Just please don't. 40% of them will reoffend. A drunk driver has broken a public trust. Having a license isn't a right, it's a privilege. After 30 years of continuing to educate and strong backup from the police in our nation and this state, drinking drivers have learned that they can do it because they can. They can't be stopped, and they continue to do it. Ignition Interlock is the absolute technology that is a win-win situation for the offender, to give them some time to realize what they've done and to get them the help they need, to continue to conduct them lives, to go to school, work, whatever they have to do. They just cannot start that car until they blow into that interlock. It protects the public, and this is a public safety issue. There's well-documented research on this, that while this interlock is on their car and they have time to get some treatment, some help, they will not reoffend. 45 to 90% of them won't try to reoffend again. A car is a dangerous weapon, and as John said, unless it's hit you, you don't realize how dangerous it is. I would also tell you, as John said, everybody appears to be so concerned about the offender. In 2005, New Mexico started the ignition interlock, and they have calculated that for every dollar spent on ignition interlock, $3 to $7 has been saved from by the public. This is a major step forward, and we firmly support ignition interlock being done by the Department of Public Safety, because it is an immediate action of separating the drunk driver from the car and not letting them continue to reoffend but live a normal life. It is a win-win situation, and I hope you consider that very carefully. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lash.
I had a question for the testifier. Ma'am?
Thank you. Representative Lash.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your testimony. I'm trying to get my head around the numbers because, as I understand it, 60% in Minnesota, at least, are first time. And from the statistics I've heard, that after the interlock, 45% of them will not reoffend. So does that bring us to the remainder being folks who will reoffend, and it cuts the reoffense rate in half? Or your New Mexico study, and by the way, with, you know, every dollar spent, we get $350 back. I'm a firm believer that when we have statistics like that, we should be able to book the savings and send it to the fiscal committees, Madam Chair, because we hear that a lot, and it may be true, but in order to ensure that that's, in fact, what we're getting back for the committee, it'd be worthwhile for us to be able to actually book the savings, and I don't know if that's the case in this instance. So in Minnesota, of the numbers, after we put this in, as best as you can tell, how much will it cut the drinking and driving rate in Minnesota, based on your past experience from other states?
Ms. Gogler.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, to the best of our ability, when that ignition interlock is on a car and a person cannot start the car, 45 to 90% of them won't reoffend or try to start the car. And that is, yeah, that is the most close statistic I can give you. If you're asking how to save the dollars, you have to remember that when somebody is killed, responses have to come from ambulances, the police department, sometimes two or three squad cars, paramedics, etc. All that adds up. When you're talking about a victim who survives the crash, which sometimes we don't remember, a person that survives the crash, and if I may tell you a quick story, we have a victim now at MAD. She's 22 years old. She's been hit by a drunk driver. I'm often told about reparation. She did get reparation. She got $5,000 to be paid $100 a month for whenever they pay it off. She has permanent brain injury. It will cost her family and insurance carriers hundreds of thousands of dollars, and she will never be well again. This is a good investment in public safety, and it's a good investment in trying to get people to realize how dangerous it is to drink and drive.
Thank you.
Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, and I appreciate that. We talk about dollars and cents, and then you talk about the human side. You can't put a price tag on the human side. There's no amount of money that will compensate someone for losing a loved one at all. But when you come in here and you say you're going to save $3 on this for every $1 spent, because we do hear that not just from you but from other testifiers and other bills, I want to know, are we going to be able to book that savings in the future? Are we going to have to spend less on other public safety programs or ambulances or things like that is what I want to know. Otherwise, it just becomes kind of a throwaway statistic. And I'm really I'm interested in the detailed statistics, not necessarily with respect to that, but with respect to how many will reoffend. And I think you've testified to the numbers to your best of your ability. But thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, if you would really like to pursue that further, I can give you some studies that will back that up from other states that have this in operation.
That would be great. If you could actually provide it to the chair, I'll make certain that everyone on the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks so much. Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and I think this is, did someone else have a, Representative Cornish?
Madam Chair, I'll make it real quick. Just, I always have to tell at least one story. My son's a state trooper in Lake Crystal, a town that I'm chief of police in, and we talk about savings. A couple weeks ago, he had a complaint of a car all over the road, and a woman was coming down, and the people who hear from fetal alcohol syndrome will appreciate this story. A woman was coming down the road, and it was said in the dispatch, we were all over the road, and my son stopped her along with one of my officers, and she was obviously drunk after a few tests, and that wasn't the worst part about it. She had a three-year-old child in the back seat, and still not the worst part of it. She pulled her shirt up and said she was 9 months pregnant, and she was due in 4 days, and her friends told her that if she drank, the baby would come early. Now, this happened to be her third DWI, and so when we talk about the ignition interlock, it really takes an importance with me that it would save her money, it would save a child, save fetal alcohol syndrome. There's a lot of savings, and the answer is yes, it'll save a lot of money, so in my humble opinion. So.
Thank you so much, Mr. Dunford. Final testifier, please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representatives, my name is Tom Edwards. I'm here as a citizen. I happen to be the recipient of the Interlock program. I am a multiple DWI offender. I'd like to preface, though, with the fact that I do support the actual program itself. It's the logistics that I have concerns with. I'm here today because there was an incident Mother's Day weekend last year, actually. There's another part to this equation. It is the B card. Some of you are aware of it, some of you may not be. I am a recipient of the B card, have been for about 25 years. Now, April 14th of this year will be 10 years without incident for me in any way, shape, or form. Mother's Day weekend, I had my brother and a friend of his arrive in town. The friend of his was from the state of Montana, had never visited Minnesota prior to this visit. On Mother's Day weekend, I had 10 emergency vehicles in front of my house for my neighbor's bonfire. Now, prior to that night, I have had incident with the city of West St. Paul. The officer that arrived originally had went by the house at 11:45 that night and arrived back at 2 minutes after 12. 2 minutes after the fire ordinance for the city of West St. Paul. Now, I have been to the city council. I've had my incidences and what have you.
Excuse me. I'm gonna ask you if you could keep it to the ignition interlock.
Sure.
Okay. Or the issue before us.
Okay. Needless to say, I was accused of drinking that night, which I wasn't. No tests were offered, and here I am. I'm on the ignition interlock program after almost 10 years without incident, without alcohol. I have the program. The company that I go through is CST. Now, I'm aware there's other companies out there. I have issues with if someone takes my car and chooses to drink and drive it, I'm the individual that would be responsible to answer because it's my car and I'm on the program. I believe there's companies out there that actually have the camera adaptation to this program that would take a picture of the individual starting your car. That would end that dispute. The safety aspect of it, it gives you approximately 6 minutes to pull over to the side of the road. And if some of you have ever driven in rush hour traffic, which I'm sure you all have, you may or may not be able to get to the shoulder of the road within 6 minutes, depending on whether you have some courteous drivers out there or not. The program, had it been around for myself on my first DWI, I probably would not be sitting in front of you as a repeat offender. So when it goes to first time, second time, third time, or fourth time, I really don't think it matters. The program conceptually is a good idea. Logistically, it definitely needs some work. When the thing goes off in your car, if you're even though you know it's in there, it squelches very loudly, it'll scare the heck out of you. You grab for the box. If it didn't fall down, slide down between the seat or whatever, you got to grab for a box approximately 4 inches wide by about 6 inches long. And if you can get over to the side of the road, great. If you can't, then you got to blow while you're rolling down the road. It may tell you missed your test when in fact you were blowing, but you didn't blow hard enough. Then if you blow too hard, it says you're too hard and blowing. It goes back through the whole thing. So you're doing this while you're trying to get over and or rolling down the road. So I guess I would urge this committee to look at the logistics to this program. As it states, it's a good program. Logistically, it needs to be worked out.
Thank you for your testimony. Further questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Bigham renews her motion that House File 3106, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations, Reform, Elections, and Technology. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Bigham. Is Representative Rood in the room? Do you want to do your bill, Representative Rood? Members, we're going to take Representative Rood's bill because all of these green T-shirts are here for Representative Rood's bill. The chair moves that House File 3059, the first engrossment, be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Representative Rood.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
House File 3059, this legislation will create an exemption to the mandated reporter law for those health care providers involved in women's prenatal care. If the woman is seeking or receiving
just
prenatal
one second.
Care.
Members of the audience, if I could ask you to please hold it down, and Representative Root, if I could ask you to maybe speak better into the microphone while they're leaving. Thanks, Representative
Root. Want me to start over?
That'd be great,
Representative
Root.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This legislation will create an exemption to the mandated reporter law for those health care providers involved in women's prenatal care. If the woman is seeking or receiving prenatal care, her providers may but will no longer be required to report her alcohol or marijuana use to the local welfare agency. Currently, if a pregnant woman discloses her substance use to her health care provider, the provider is mandated to report her to the local welfare agency. Our current system lacks adequate resources for non-addicted, non-dependent women. The county agencies that receive the mandatory reports and do the screening have little to offer if they are not addicted. While passed with the best intentions, I think it was in 2007, there are concerns with this statute that it has created some unintended consequences, acting as a barrier to early entry into prenatal care. In seeking to address this issue, we have worked with the Minnesota Organization of Fetal Alcohol Syndrome, which supports the bill, and ACOG, which supports the policy direction of this bill. In addition, we have worked with the chair. And with that, Madam Chair, I do have some testifiers, if that would be okay.
Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Patricia Harrison. I'm the research director for the City of Minneapolis Department of Health. I'm here today to support this bill because it fulfills a request by our community members for confidential prenatal health services to support quitting substance use during pregnancy. We work closely with community members through Twin City Healthy Start, a federally funded program that provides education and case management services for women who are at high risk for poor birth outcomes. The program is one way the City of Minneapolis is working to reduce the racial disparities in health, including infant mortality. A high program priority is to increase use of prenatal care in the first trimester. Overwhelming scientific evidence shows that the earlier a woman enters care, the more likely it is that our health care providers can work with her to reduce all the risks that can affect birth outcomes and poor maternal health. These include tobacco, alcohol, and drug use, as well as inadequate nutrition, obesity, high blood pressure, and diabetes. Despite our efforts and those of many community partners, including MOFAS, first trimester prenatal care remains well below targets, and we still find large disparities between white women and women of color. To understand why women delay or forego care, we conducted focus groups with African American and American Indian women because these groups have the highest risks for poor birth outcomes, and they have persistently lower rates of first trimester prenatal care. Many women knew about the importance of prenatal care, but time and time again, they stated stories of fear and mistrust of healthcare providers, in part because they were afraid that their drug and alcohol use would be reported and that their babies would be taken away from them. When we asked them what would motivate women to enter prenatal care sooner, focus group members told us to make prenatal care visits confidential and exempt from from mandatory reporting. As one woman put it, visits should be confidential because if you're able to find out what's going on, you open the door for the pregnant woman to come back, and then you can help her. These women want to be able to talk honestly about their substance use, and they want to get help to quit. The apparent disparities in the application of the law are of great concern to us. Many more women of color than white women are reported. This phenomenon is seen in other states as well that have similar laws. Even though studies have found that white women are just as likely or even more likely to be using substances during pregnancy, they're less likely to be screened by their providers for substance use, and it's less likely to be documented in their medical charts. So we've been told that mandatory reports tripled in the Twin City area after 2007, largely due to the addition of marijuana to the reporting law. Because alcohol and marijuana are used much more widely than the other substances during pregnancy, many more women, particularly women of color, were affected by this change in the law. And the message about this broader reach really resonated throughout our local communities. While our ultimate aim is no substance use during pregnancy, national and our own evidence shows that the overwhelming majority of women who continue to use alcohol and drugs during pregnancy use infrequently and in relatively small amounts. The county welfare agencies are hard-pressed to help these women as they focus their limited resources on the women with more serious substance use patterns and addictions. Pregnant substance users need to be identified within the context of prenatal care and an ongoing relationship of trust. Some communities do not believe the government's message about the dangers of alcohol and other drugs during pregnancy, and they certainly don't believe that this law was designed to help them. Prenatal care providers can tailor their messages to each individual, understanding the factors related to their use and helping them quit. They can also provide resources for them in the community. They can refer women for an assessment if they have concerns about their level of use. And if they feel that the county program is the best option, they can still make that voluntary report under this law. We believe modifying the law is a vital step towards supporting women and their health care providers in their efforts to reduce substance use during pregnancy. By reducing the reluctance to engage in honest discussion, we can help both patients and providers find the best ways to achieve substance use, substance-free pregnancies. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Next testifier, please try not to repeat anything that's been said, but go ahead.
My name is Sarah Masselt, and I'm Executive Director at the Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. MOFAS was founded in 1998 by former First Lady Susan Carlson. Mrs. Carlson continues to be actively engaged as a board president, and she, as well as our board of directors, supports the proposed change in this legislation. I will be very brief. FASD is common. Over 8,500 Minnesota babies will be born this year prenatally exposed to alcohol, which can lead to permanent brain damage. FASD is costly. By preventing just one case of FASD, we know we can save Minnesota taxpayers money. And most importantly, and somewhat ironically, FASD is 100% preventable if women do not drink when they are pregnant. Many women who are planning their pregnancies eliminate alcohol. Many women drink alcohol, and many women quit drinking when they find out they are pregnant. But some women do not. Why? Is it lack of information? Lack of support? Is she chemically dependent? Does she not believe that drinking can hurt her baby? We know all of these responses are true. It's a complex and multi-layered problem. To solve this problem, we know one thing for sure. We all need to work together to find solutions that work. The current language in the law is not only a deterrent for women who may be drinking to seek prenatal care, but it is a huge deterrent for prenatal care providers to be motivated to build a trusting and strong relationship with their parents. In fact, many physicians tell us it's impossible to build a trusting relationship with your patient if you know the law requires you to report her alcohol use when she is brave enough to take the first step and disclose that that is what she is doing. Although problems that face our society such as these can be challenging and complicated, this issue we are discussing today really is not. It just makes common sense for the language to be updated. If a pregnant woman is doing the right thing, she's seeking prenatal care, she's being honest about her use, and she's reaching out to do what's right for her and her baby, she should be supported for this effort, and the result will be a win-win for her and for all of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Please go ahead, state your name for the record.
My name is Amy Godecker, and I'm an epidemiologist also with the Minneapolis Department of Health, and I'm here to speak today on behalf of Dr. Lydia Karos, who's the executive director of the Native American Community Clinic. And Dr. Karos apologizes, but she had clinic hours this afternoon and had to get back to the clinic at 2. So she asked me to speak for her. And she wanted to testify about, if there's not mandatory reporting, what is the alternative? What can prenatal care providers do? And for the last 20 years, Dr. Karos' physician group has been providing prenatal alcohol screening in the Phillips neighborhood, and that's Representative Clark's district. Dr. Karras's patients know that her clinic cares very deeply about prenatal substance use and that they do everything they can to provide support and education for quitting. When women in her clinic enter prenatal care, about 60% of them have been using alcohol, but after repeated screening and persistent education about the issue, only 1 to 2% of women in her clinic continue to drink during pregnancy. And by any standard, that's a remarkable success rate. Dr. Karras's group has taught their method of prenatal care screening and education to 15 different clinics in the Twin Cities area over the last 10 years with similar success rates, and she believes that it's practical, effective, and doable in a busy clinical setting. And she believes that if all providers used her program consistently, more women would be getting help rather than avoiding care and recovery. Dr. Karras also has a toolkit that's readily available now, and she is willing and available to train other providers in clinic. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, the Chair renews her motion that House File 3059, first engrossment, be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Root.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Bigham. Is she here yet? Okay. Representative Bigham moves that House File 3213 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Representative Bigham, please be brief. We have 25 minutes left of this committee, and we still have the entire committee report. So Representative Bigham moves the A1 amendment to get the bill. You don't want to do it.
Madam Chair, after Bigham. Consideration and consulting with counsel, they would feel that adding that amendment would cause another committee stop. And, well, I don't want to do that.
Okay.
I hate to disappoint people, but I don't want to go to another committee.
Representative Bigham.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. House File 3213 is adding the drug tramadol to the Schedule 4 of controlled substances. Here with me is Michael Radmer, Assistant County Attorney with Hennepin County Attorney's Office, and I also do have Cody Weiberg here, who is the Executive Director of the Board of Pharmacy, who can answer questions if there are any about that, but they do support the bill. So I'll let Mr. Radmer talk.
Before I let you go, is there anyone in the audience who's going to be testify in opposition to this bill? Just kind of gauge how much pro testimony we need.
Okay.
Representative Bigham, there isn't anyone in the audience who's going to testify against your bill, so keep that in mind when you have your testifiers speak.
Okay, well, if Mr. Radman just wants to speak why it's necessary, then.
Okay.
Thank
Please
you,
go
Madam.
Ahead, state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mike Radmer, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney. Thank you, members, for this opportunity. Briefly, tramadol is a powerful powerful painkiller. It is not presently a controlled substance. This merely is a technical fix to add it to the schedule, and with that, I'll defer to any questions from members.
Questions from members? Seeing none. And is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Bigham renews her motion that House File 3213 be recommended pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Bigham. Representative Johnson. Representative Johnson moves that House File 2639 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Just briefly, Madam Chair, members, what this bill does is require wireless telecommunications company, otherwise known as cell phone companies, for our purpose, to release what's called the location information of a missing person's cell phone to law enforcement to respond to emergencies involving the risk of death or serious physical harm. And as way of background, the bill stems from an unfortunate tragedy that occurred in Kansas a couple years ago when an 18-year-old was kidnapped and murdered. The parents wrangled with the cell phone companies for about 4 days to try to get the cell phone information, call location information, and had a very hard time doing that. Once they were able to get it, they were able to locate the body within 45 minutes. Shortly thereafter, the state of Kansas passed a law called the Kelsey-Smith Act, which is essentially the bill before you. The main feature of the bill, and there's the sections that apply to this particular committee are in paragraphs A and D of Section 2. In Section 2, Part A, it states that the telecom service provider shall provide the call location information, and it's the shall provide that's really the heart of the bill. Cell phone laws is regulated by and large by federal law via the FCC, and their language for releasing this kind of information entails the language may provide. So the major change, again, is the notion that the cell phone company shall provide this call location information.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Questions from members? Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, what I'm worried about is accountability. Is it, without looking at them, trying to find the bill here, is it police only, not just EMS, that this is released to, and what's the accountability as far as the information? It just so not everybody gets turned in a verified emergency. And if Mr. Neumeister might have a couple of words of education for us on this.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cornish, we've been working on that particular point of data privacy concerns with stakeholders and with Mr. Neumeister as well. There's a couple changes that are going to be coming forth in a delete all amendment that will be between this committee and the next committee, assuming this moves forward. For example, in paragraph A where it says upon request, it'll be a documented request, and the person requesting information will be a law enforcement agency rather than a particular person, so it'll be specific to a law enforcement agency. And with respect to emergency services in 1.21, it'll be emergency situation. So we're going to tighten up the confidential or the data stuff.
Representative Cornish.
Just one thing is, if as you go ahead and do that, if you would instead of law enforcement officer, put in there peace officer as defined by 626, it gives a better definition than law enforcement. That's kind of an old term.
Right, very good.
Takes care of all peace officers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Cornish.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Representative Neumeister, thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. Sorry, Mr. Neumeister. Please keep in mind to keep it to the area that is within the jurisdiction of
the committee. Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I very seldom appear before your committee, but I'm very much obliged to you. I have a handout, if I may.
We'll take a look at it. Somebody want to?
Madam Chair, then if everyone can take a look at the bill. Basically, let's how, because you talk about the federal language, you've got to remember that the federal law has privacy of communications. This involves electronic communications. This involves wiretaps, all kinds of broadly, privacy of communications. The federal law sets the floor, and then the states can do certain things. In this area, in the handout that I gave to you, is the federal law that they're describing, which is now May, which was part of the Patriot Act in 2001, where they added the exclusion information, where information can be shared. Now, one of the things that I have some concerns about is that the federal law sets a minimum standard for privacy. And so it's a may disclose where it leaves the phone company to evaluate the request by law enforcement. But now what we're doing, we're changing the may to shall, so that when a request is made by law enforcement, it's basically mandated from my perspective. And so when this is being done, and where there might be a question of how federal law and ambiguity in here, I believe it's important for accountability and transparency. Now, some of the things that Representative Johnson shared with you, yes, it's going to be documented. It's going to be some type of format. It's going to be tightened up a little bit. But some of the other things that I brought to his attention and probably still being worked on, I'd like to share with you in the bill itself where this, folks, you deal with this on accountability issues. One is that, number one, it talks about an investigative or law enforcement officer. Now, one of the things that's going to be happening here is that basically the volume, I contend the volume is going to go up rather than when you say shall. And using that standard, the current language now, If a person does not necessarily have to be missing. It can be a person saying, oh, I haven't, I believe someone is going to do a certain situation or whatever. Can you find that person? One of the concerns I have is the abuse that may happen with law enforcement. So one of the things that I'm looking for, accountability and transparency, like when you say a law enforcement officer, it should be law enforcement agency. There should be someone designated in the law enforcement agency that's going to be handling all these kinds of requests. So there's some accountability there. Number two, one of the things that I've asked in my suggestions to Representative Johnson and the phone companies, that there be some type of accountability in terms of how the phone company, the wireless companies are going to handle these requests. And they do have protocols. I didn't have a copy with me, but AT&T has like a document that they send. And I'm interested for that document and those protocols to be given to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension so the public knows to make sure that the privacy of where people are at are accountable. Number two, and the other thing, this is a concept, is like how many of these requests are happening on an annual basis that maybe the wireless companies can share with the BCA. So Madam Chair, members of the committee, I've just shared some, I believe, some important accountability, transparency rules, some accountability so that this will not be abused as a possible fishing expedition. And you've got to remember, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the technology is changing fast, and if you don't set some of the rules now, we don't know what's happening. So I'm just trying to share with you what I'm just trying to give some important things, and I know that Sheldon, Representative Johnson, as this bill goes forward, hopefully those are some issues that can still be dealt with. But as a courtesy, I wanted to let you know what those were.
Representative Johnson, we're going to need to amend your motion to actually send it to the Civil Law Committee, Representative Johnson, instead of to the General Register. And I would assume that you'll continue to work on these issues while you go and deal with
data issues.
Who had a question? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Neumeister, the concerns that you just talked, you sound like you've expressed some of the concerns to Representative Johnson. Did you express all of them, and did you get an answer to them that you feel comfortable? It doesn't sound like you're comfortable with what he's come back with. And is there something that you're asking law enforcement or other people to come and testify on this bill about that you're concerned about?
Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I have an amendment that was going to be done at your committee that I felt very comfortable with. I thought balanced it, but some of the wireless companies did not feel that was too much burden on them or whatever it might be. I don't know what all their points were. So that amendment was not offered here. So working at least, there was preliminarily maybe some understanding that the other side of this had some questions about it. That's why the bill's still continuing with still some things unmet from my perspective.
Representative Anderson, then Cornish, then Mason. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Neumeister, did you have a chance to talk with the wireless telecommunications companies that they didn't feel comfortable with your bill? Do they feel comfortable with Representative Johnson's bill the way it is going forward? Do they agree with it?
Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, they accepted the documented portion of it, and they narrowed the definition, narrowed the definition, which as the bill was originally introduced. In some of the accountability aspects of it, or the transparency aspects, at least from talking with them just generally over the past few weeks, and at least from points I've heard from others, they would not be acceptable to those kinds of things. At least the BCA part, to give their protocols and their process, by speaking with Mr. Murphy, who represents AT&T on this, they were still reviewing that. So I haven't heard about that aspect of it.
Representative Cornish.
Oh, Madam Chair, for Representative Mullery, I was just going to make a comment for Representative Johnson and Mullery here, that when it gets to your committee, the things that bother me, I guess, that are really broad, investigative, there's no current definition, I don't think, in statute on investigative, what kind of a person that would be. If it would
worker at Sears, or and then emergency situation, the definition of that and the definition of serious physical harm, a lot of the things makes it so broad, and then to say they shall have to provide upon that vague description, just if you could tighten that up somehow, that'd be great.
That'd be great. Representative Mason.
Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, in telecom, we did hear from the various cell phone providers, and the systems that they explained to me sounded like they cover most of the testifier's issues. And so my thought is, you know, like if Representative Johnson would just give me some clarification on that. And in particular, the one comment was, it set up that they will not really, if it's somebody that just doesn't want to be found, they will not release the information from that center. So, thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mason. The cell phone companies have been cooperative in working together on all these issues. I'm sure they're in the audience. We're going to testify if you had something specific, but they've been working with us as we move this bill forward.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Neumeister, Representative Johnson, and maybe this is, gets to what Representative Cornish is alluding to, is the criteria. I don't see in the bill any specific details as to what, I mean, you mentioned emergency situations, death, or serious physical harm, but what, and I guess that's where I would want the BCA or law enforcement or somebody to come up and say, this is criteria underneath those these broad terms that are being said that would allow the wireless telecommunications service to let law enforcement have access or go forward with locating such individual, so forth. To me, it's too broad in the way it's been written.
Representative Cornish.
No.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I've got some of the same concerns. The question I had, Representative Johnson, was if the phone is working in the place or wherever trying to call the number, is there anything in here that precludes them from being part of that same order?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure I understand the question.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Johnson, if the phone is working, as I remember, there was an issue last year where somebody fell off of a big rock ledge, and the authorities would call the cell phone number. Obviously, there was no answer, and I understand that that's kind of what we're getting at here. But if indeed someone is calling and answering at the other, and going back to Representative Mason's comments, if the phone is working, there wouldn't be any reason for them to secure these types of records, I would expect. Can we cut them out of it as well?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, the way they'd locate the cell phone is through pings to the tower locations, the towers that are surrounding where the cell phone is, and they would triangulate and get a general geographical area of where that cell phone was pinging from. So that's all the information they need, is to kind of to locate where the geography where the phone is currently located. That's kind of the point of the call location information. That's what they're trying to secure.
Mr. Neumeister.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Druskowski. And also, since it was brought up about the ping, which we've all heard about, you have to remember technology is moving fast now to where a lot of phones are now starting to have specific kind of GPS things in it. So the satellite in the sky will tell you, you know, real specifically. This is why it's important to have some, you know, points and things discussed, because I think there are some privacy interests, but you also want to do a good thing, locate people in where those situations where it's important to do so.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Representative Johnson renews his motion that House File 2639 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Committee on Civil Justice. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Lesh. Representative Lesh, we're going to do the Crime Victims and Criminal Records Division report, and we're going to do Representative Greiling's bill first. Representative Lesh moves to adopt the division reports on House File 3130, 3090, 3089, 2695, 891, 3131, 3312, and 3381. And we're going to have all of those bills up. So All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Lesh, do you want to?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, we have been busy taking them in order as stated, Madam Chair. First, on that date, March 9th, the division did take up, starting with 3312, intentional harm to a service dog. Penalty provided with Representative Greiling did add to the current law that if you intentionally harm a service dog and render the animal unable to perform its duties, it's a gross misdemeanor. The bill also allows the judge to order restitution similar to when a pet attacks a service dog. Current law that if you intentionally cause bodily harm to a service animal, it would be a felony. And we heard testimony from an individual, a testifier, that Representative Greiling got was compelling testimony about her being in a downtown Target store and her dog was intentionally kicked by another individual. They were able to go ahead and prosecute in that instance, but this would enhance the ability for them to secure conviction. No one did speak in opposition to this.
Let's just take Representative Greiling's and then pass that so she can go chair her committee meeting at 2:45.
Absolutely, Madam.
Are there questions regarding that bill for Representative Greiling? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Concern is by several members that where it says cause bodily harm to the animal or otherwise render the animal unable to perform its duties, that the word between a word like substantially or permanently be put in between the word otherwise render, and just we're asking for the author's thoughts on that.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Anderson. I wish my second author, Representative Coles, were here, who could help out with this, who signed on after Representative Lesh's committee. He and I did discuss this very concept, and I ran it by the American Council for the Blind of Minnesota, who are the ones who brought forward this bill, and we do have Chris Bell in the audience who may want to speak to this suggestion. He's their board chair of their advocacy and legislative committee, but they preferred that we not put any adjectives in there, as you are suggesting, because when an animal is kicked and rendered unable to perform its services, as in the testifier in the previous committee, there could be, could be permanently disabled. These are $50,000 dogs, but it also could be disabled for 2 days or a week, and they wanted to be able to recoup transportation services without a dog. The person who's guided by the dog needs to get to work or get to the doctor or whatever their appointments are. So they wanted to leave it open-ended. So I think they would oppose that amendment, but I would leave it to the committee to discuss.
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling. Well, yes, it's funny that you should say your second co-author, because he's the one that would like to see that put in there, either one, that word or permanently rendered.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Anderson. He and I had discussed it after the committee, but have you talked to him since the House floor today? Because that's when I did talk with him and said that the American Council of the Blind preferred not to have that amendment and why. But I was open to the amendment up until I'd had that discussion with them, and I canceled the suggestion when I talked with Representative Cole. So I'm not sure if he talked to you before or after the House floor.
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, no, I have not talked to him since the floor.
Representative Lesh and then Begum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I would oppose that addition for this reason. I think that if you've got a service dog upon which a disabled individual wholly relies for their getting around or livelihood or what have you, the animal either can perform its duties or it can't. So you can either get around or you can't. It's kind of like the inability to be a little bit pregnant, Madam Chair. You either are or you aren't. And in this instance, if even an intentional act renders a service dog partially unable to perform its duties, that's enough for you to fall under the umbrella of what we're trying to achieve here. Which is why I like the language the way it is, Madam Chair.
Representative Begum.
I was going to say something similar to Representative Lesh, but the first thing
Representative Grattan, thank you for bringing this forward. This is a great bill. And the only thing I would add is that there's discretion by the prosecutor, Representative Anderson, that, you know, to deal with whether they would charge someone or not and and maybe they would consider the severity of the, like Representative West said, the severity of the injury if regarding their decision to charge or not.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill that did not testify in Representative Lesh's committee? Seeing none, Representative Lesh renews his motion that House File 3312 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Greiling. Members, I'm going to ask that you all stick your stuff back in your folder as we sent out in the announcement. We will be reconvening at 2:45 in room 500 south of the State Office Building. Representative Greiling's committee gets this room now, and we need to move. With that, this meeting is in recess. The chair is going to reconvene the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. Today is Tuesday, March 19th. Representative Champion, I will move that House File 891 be recommended to pass and be sent to, let's go to the General Register. It's going to the General Register. And Representative Champion, it's my understanding that you have two amendments, and I will move the amendments to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. The first is the DE2 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. And the A2 amendment, again, to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Champion, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Because I know that brevity is the order of the day, as there are tons of bills that are before you, I would first of all like to say thank you for hearing this bill. The amendments that you've already adopted are a reflection of the hard work that has been put into this bill by the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers and the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Not only that, but it's also a reflection of the great work of the Council on Crime and Justice. And to my left, I'm pleased to also have with me Phil Crothers, who is the chief adult prosecutor for Ramsey County and the former Speaker of the House, who's done a great work around this notion of expungements. Also, the other person who is missing, who had to go into the Senate, but I want to be very respectful of their great work, is David Brown, who's with the Hampton County Attorney's Office. So, of course, to respect the county attorneys, I want to pay tribute to them. This particular bill, Your Honor, of course, I'm a lawyer, so you know I'm used to saying Your Honor. But, Madam Chair, number one, what it does, it does a number of things. It preserves the current expungement availability, so it does not do anything to the current law. And it gives statutory authority for expungement at stages of adjudication if the petitioner has not been charged with any new crime for 1 year following discharge from probation. If the prosecutor agreed to the stay of adjudication, that permissive work can be seen by way of an expungement. Currently, only court and probation records are available to be expunged, and this allows all workers, including the executive branch workers, to be expunged. Secondly, this legislation gives statutory authority for expungement of pleas like diversion programs. If the petitioner has not been charged with any new crimes for 1 year following discharge from the diversion program, and if the prosecutor agrees to the diversion. Currently, only court and probation records are able to be expunged. This allows all records, including administrative expungement. Removes expungement hearing requirement for stays of adjudication and diversion programs if the prosecutor agrees to the expungement and makes a good faith effort to inform any victims. And we also believe that it's important for the a copy of the complaint or the police reports to be attached. And also, this change, as you have adopted, also allows prosecutors and law enforcement to go back into the records if they believe that they need to for sentencing purposes or for investigation. So we believe it saves money by reducing the number of court hearings, and it only involves cases where all charges were ultimately dismissed. And as I mentioned earlier, it's generally supported by criminal defense lawyers and prosecutors, and it does not expand the current expungement law. rather allows for complete expungement. And to that, I would like to allow, if you can, just for a minute, for the Carruthers to have a moment.
Welcome to the committee, former Representative Carruthers. Representative Carruthers held this seat prior to me, so welcome back.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members. The Minnesota County Attorneys Association has worked closely with the defense lawyers and with the Council on Crime and Justice, and we think that this is a good way to make it easier for people who deserve to get an expungement to get it. So that's why we support it.
Anyone else?
Yes. Madam Chair, also Mark Haas is here from the Council on Crime and Justice, and he's also the Chief Architect of the Durban Census. Great work together.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Mark Housie with the Council on Crime and Justice. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I think one thing that always helps in explaining this, it's very quick, is understanding of, you know, what we often see people coming to us in situations. It kind of puts it into a concrete example. And this is pretty much all this does as far as expanding the current expungement law, like Representative Champion. It's just these types of cases that now can be sealed at all the branches. And what happens is, you know, low-level, often first-time offenders get what's called a stay of adjudication, which means that if they complete their probation successfully, then they aren't considered convicted of the crime. And the idea, I think Mr. Carruthers would agree, one idea in doing that is to get somebody who's initially broken the law to be able to move on and become law-abiding in the future. Well, they're told they won't have a conviction on their record, but the stay of adjudication or the diversion program is still on their record. So employers or landlords, under current Minnesota law, can see that for almost the rest of their life. And the employers and landlords don't know the difference between a stay of adjudication or a conviction. They just, generally speaking, see that this person was, you know, had a run-in with the law. So all this does is allow, if the prosecutors agree and the person remains crime-free for a year after the completion of the sentence, then they can have a complete remedy and make it easier for them to remain lawful.
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, the chair renews her motion that House File 891 be recommended to pass as amended and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Champion. Representative Lesh, House File 3130, I believe, is the next item. That would be your bill. Representative Lesh moves that House File 3130 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is Jerry Strike in here? There he is. Madam Chair, just by way of explanation, this is a bill that passed out with not a lot of fanfare, but this is common sense provision. If Chief Strike could just explain very briefly what it's doing and why it's needed.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, committee, thank you. My name is Jerry Strike. I'm the fire chief of the Centennial Fire District, which covers the cities of Lionel Lake, Centerville, and Circle Pines. I'm also representing the Minnesota Fire Chief Association. This bill will change the language of a bill that was adopted in the 1980s that allows the fire chief to conduct what we call a post-employment criminal history check for current employees. Our current statutes only allow us to conduct a criminal history check on candidates. After the 1 year, the consent would be needed. And every now and then, we end up hiring an employee who, in the long term, 5, 10, 15, 20 years later, ends up getting involved in crime, and we have no statutory right to conduct their criminal history unless we have their consent. An example of that will be August of 2008. I took the helm of the Centennial Fire Chief, wanted to conduct a background check on one individual that I knew had some issues with violent crime. I could not get that information. I continued to work towards removing the individual from the department. I know this is an extreme measure, but in October of 2009, you may have seen on the news, my employee, a firefighter, killed his wife and then himself. That puts great disrespect on the fire district and the firefighters in general. And had I had the information that I needed, I feel strongly, as the chiefs do, that we would have been able to at least mitigate the firefighter issue.
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Lesch renews his motion that House File 3130 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Members, I'm just going to sit here and move House File 3090 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Committee. Members, I also move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Members, this is the stalking crime modification bill. What ended up happening is the law is not clear, and so there have been a whole bunch of groups and advocates that have been working together to clarify this, just to make the law clear. They are all here if members have questions, but if there are no questions, I'd like to ask for members' support. So questions from members. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Michael Harrison. I am the editor and publisher of Judicial Common Sense. I do feel that we do need some sort of stalking law, but I have a lot of concerns with the language in this bill. My first concern is the definition of changing harass to stalking. And I, as a trained paralegal, I've done some legal research on this. I've looked up what the definition of harass and stalking in the Black's Dictionary, which is usually considered the first authority by a court. And they both basically are the same, except for the subset of stalking, where it involves advanced influences or acts of following or monitoring others by stealth, is the way they define it. My concern with this bill is giving subdivision to small a and all the clauses in it. A lot of those clauses, I think, can work either way, as a stalking or harassment. Although I get particularly concerned as a father of a teenage daughter that likes to call up boys for whatever reason, hangs up, says something, this could be construed as stalking. And I think it's just a bunch of, children having fun on the telephone. I don't think anything actually comes out of it. And my concern is that the next thing I know, my daughter, with the stiff penalties that this bill has as felonies, is that my 13-year-old daughter is going to be, or 14, I should say, if it was last week, charged with felonies. And I myself could be charged with a felony for allowing her to use my telephone. I have a lot of problems with that. I don't think that's right. I understand there's a public safety policy and that stalking should be seriously dealt with. And anybody that engages into that must have some serious mental health problems and that should be addressed. The other concern I have with this bill is the venue. And my concern is that it says that, if an act is committed in two counties, that either county can charge that person. My concern is that if both counties decide to go after and prosecute for that same crime, would that not constitute double jeopardy? And so I think some language should be put in the bill where, one county has maybe six offenses where the other one has three, the one gets to take the prosecution end of it. I just am very concerned as a paralegal that double jeopardy could become an issue, and I know that from my research that the Minnesota Supreme Court, giving the law as it is now, has already struck down parts of this law because of First Amendment rights, although I don't think any of my concerns have to do with the First Amendment. But That's all I have. Any concerns, and be willing to answer any questions.
Thank you. Members, questions from members? All right, members, I'm actually going to have the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women come to the table and address the concerns of the witness. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
I'm Liz Richards. I'm with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. I'll just quickly address both of those points. First, in terms of definitions, currently under the statutes, we have no clear definition of stalking. The stalking law is referred to as harassment stalking, and the current law is a definition of harassment, but not a definition of stalking. Further, what confuses matters, the definition under the harassment stalking statute as it stands right now is a different definition of harassment than exists in the 609.748, which is the harassment restraining order. So we have different definitions of harassment law. So what we're doing here is removing harassment. We aren't changing the crime. What we're doing is trying to clarify so that what exists under the harassment stalking law will be consistently referred to as stalking. It's not a list of behaviors. Those are the same list that exists right now in the law. Just a matter of changing some of that language so it's clear what constitutes stalking. I would also note that the behaviors enumerated in subdivision 2A, those behaviors are only one of the pieces that has to happen for stalking to be charged. You also have to show that the behavior was entered into where the actor knows or has a reason to know that the behavior is prohibited, and also that it causes fear or intimidation within the intended victim. So it's a lot more complicated than just merely engaging in behaviors such as posting or texting. In terms of the venue, under the current statute, the same venue provision exists under a pattern of stalking, which is one of the felony provisions in the law. So what it says is that if there are multiple acts of stalking that occur across different counties, any one county can charge the whole pattern. So you have one charge arising that would cover multiple counties. Because what we've heard from some prosecutors is that they don't necessarily want to charge the felony level stalking offense, but would like to charge the lower level stalking offense, but it might be that there were multiple instances going across multiple counties, that they would like to be able to charge those multiple at a lower level but still cover behaviors that go across county lines. So that's what it's doing. And this has been in the law. We have not had any problems with it that we have ever heard of.
Questions from members?
Madam Chair.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I would have a question for the witness or maybe somebody who might be here from law enforcement or the courts. I've heard about the harassment restraining orders from actually people who work in the courts, and they believe that those are they're actually abused quite a bit throughout the state and are causing our courts to be clogged up and are really used as an alternative to actual charges. I'm curious, with the stalking statute or the proposed stalking statute, 609.749, whether that is also the case. And then I also have a concern about line 1.8 and striking the word intentional. That broadens things out and takes a focus off of intentional acts, which I really wonder what the reason for that is.
Representative Druskowski, let me start by saying that this does not have the harassment orders in it for this bill, and I would like to defer to my testifier regarding the reason for taking out intentional. Ms. Richards.
Madam Chairman, Representative Druskowski. The intentional conduct, if you notice, subdivision 1A, this was added later, that initially it just talks about intentional conduct, and then it talks then right after that the actor knows or has reason to know, and it goes into various language. There was a court case that because there's some confusion about whether that intentional conduct was talking about whether this is a general intent crime or a specific intent crime. And based on that case law, the legislature came back and put in 1A, said that is not a specific intent crime. But at that time, no one struck the intentional conduct. It's our understanding from working with various prosecutors that the fact that the intentional conduct still sits up there is some confusion about whether this is a general intent crime, which is what the intention was when subdivision 1A was added. So it's still a general intent crime and has, so, you know, accidental conduct is not this type, as any crime would be a general intent crime. And that's the reason for striking that term up there, is to make sure it's rid of that confusion.
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, I was just wondering if what we were talking about was in relationship to a letter that was put on our desk when we were down in room 10, but in talking with Representative Cornish, it was something different. But it relates to the gentleman that basically stalked his ex-girlfriend, and if you've got the letter, everybody got the letter on their desk. It talked about how he was supposed to stay away from his ex-girlfriend, and in so doing, he ended up murdering his ex-girlfriend and her father, her stepfather. And even though with a court order in place to keep him away from him, he continued even from jail to persistently go after her and hit her family. So I'm just wondering if this like the stalking situation, if there can be further references to something like that where personal intentionally defies the law that's in front of that he's been prosecuted.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not sure exactly. I think that I'm not going to speak to the specific facts of that case vis-a-vis the stalking statute. It's possible, depending on all the facts. I believe that the Anna Grunewald testimony really is going to be going to a separate bill that looked at some of the provisions of pretrial bail, witness tampering, which would have been a fit to those specific facts of that case.
And that's coming up yet.
I understand. I just, the only reason I bring it up is because of the fact that the gentleman or the individual continued to go after after the individual that was killed. So,
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a quick question on a delete as well on line 3.3. So the peace officer may not make a warrantless custodial arrest of any person. So now we're allowing them to make a warrantless arrest.
Ms. Richards.
Madam Chair, Representative Kelly. The delete, if you look at, I believe it's 2.7, where it was a specific arrest provision, the delete is only to, it's moving it to a different part of the statute. That's why there's a delete. The language is carrying across. And what the arrest does is, the law has been that you can make a warrantless arrest under stalking, and that's set out in 629.34. The statute just merely referenced that, and there was some confusion because the one provision that doesn't qualify for warrantless arrest is when it has to do with a law enforcement officer being involved, and those don't qualify. So this was to put it out in a clear subdivision to state what the law is. It's not a change in the law, it's just making it clear and reiterating it. The delete all happens because it got moved.
Questions from members? Seeing none, the chair. Representative Druskowski, sorry I didn't see you.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Ms. Richards, I struggle. I guess maybe I even struggle with the current law there. You talked about the specific versus general intent, and I'm trying to understand that more. But the way I read that there, you know, there doesn't have to be any intentional attempt or any intent to frighten, threaten, oppress, persecute, or intimidate anyone. So line 2.13, then we say it can be done directly or indirectly or through third parties, and we're going to add that in. I don't know fully the implications of what that may mean. You know, we're in a day when we're almost in the race to victimhood sometimes, and I'm wondering if we're broadening this so much that we're going to create abilities for abuse of the law and abuse of the process and abuse of the government.
Ms. Richards.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Druskowski. The change, the bill still is a general intent crime, as would be any crime, and you have to show conduct that knows or has reason to know, that full paragraph. You have to show all of those things, plus show depending on what you're charging under the statute, whatever those other provisions are. The law already has said that this isn't, you don't have to show anything, you don't have to show the specific intent, which is a higher standard. That was already passed, I don't know when it was passed, but a number of years ago, So this isn't changing the standard at all. This is just a clarification around that.
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, I was just going to say intentional, along with the other descriptions in there, makes the bar too high, and this is for protection of the victim, and I like it the way it is. Change. And what was the other question, Representative Duskowski? You had that, the second part?
Representative Duskowski?
2.13, Tony.
Representative Cornish?
Well, through third parties, I would imagine that would mean, like the case we had recently where a person's been ordered not to contact somebody, but they're doing it through another person. Like in a no-contact order, they try to get around it, but getting a friend to help them harass them and through their own devices. I mean, this happens a lot where you get somebody think, okay, I want to do it, but I'll get my buddy to do it.
Seeing no further questions, the chair renews her motion that House File 3090 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Committee. All those in favor?
As amended.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Paymar moves that House File 3089 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Committee. Representative Paymar, it's my understanding that you have two amendments. So Representative Paymar moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that he would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And Representative Paymar, oh, I think that was it, just one amendment. Representative Paymar.
Madam Chair, this bill basically does two things. First of all, it amends the current statute to provide that domestic abuse no contact orders are criminal orders and can be included in a condition of release. Currently, the no contact orders are established in the state's civil law statute, which may lead to criminal defendants being released without a no contact order being in place. And I think we're all aware of the horrible tragedy that happened earlier last year with Officer Richard Crittenden, when Officer Richard Crittenden was murdered while responding to a domestic violence call, and the woman had an active no contact order and were pending criminal matters. And we know that situation. I understand that the family of Officer Crittenden is, mispronouncing his name, are in the audience today. And so this provides that clarification. And the second thing the bill does, it expands the statute to include intentional acts or attempts to prevent or dissuade a person from attending or testifying at a proceeding authorized by law. What we have found is that oftentimes offenders, batterers, will threaten and try to dissuade a person from attending a court hearing or obtaining a civil order for protection, so this puts some additional teeth in the tampering statute. And finally, this bill amends the maximum bail statute for non-felony offenses to allow judges to set, and that's the amendment that we just passed, the amount it changes it from 6 times the fine to 10 times the fine. The original bill lifted all ceilings for bail amounts, but this is trying to deal with the fact that judges should be looking at some of the risk that a batterer may pose upon release and take that into consideration when setting bail.
Question from?
We have someone from NCW who...
I think I'll just save their questions.
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
My name is Wayne Crittenden. Officer Crittenden is my brother, and had his bill for the bail be in place at the time, and he be held in jail on a higher bail as requested by Ramsey County, my brother would still be here. And I would not have to be here today. So I am in strong support of this. Thank you.
Questions from members? Thank you for sharing your story. With that, Representative Paymar renews his motion that House File 3089 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by... Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, the amendment, was that put on?
Correct, Representative Anderson, it was.
Okay, I didn't hear you say amended, so I just...
Oh, as amended. Thank you for making that clarification. Representative Paymar moves that House File 3089 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Paymar moves that House File 2965 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Committee. Representative Paymar.
This is 2965, I'm sorry.
That's correct. Okay. And Representative Paymar, I will have to make the motion to say as amended because you amended it in division. So just so we're not confused later. Representative Paymar.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, just to clarify what this is this bill came out of the scandal that happened with the Metro Gang Strike Force. It is a combination of recommendations from the legislative auditor as well as from Mr. Luger, who was hired by the Department of Public Safety to investigate what happened with the Metro Gang Strike Force. With that, I'd like Mr. Noble just to say a couple words about what about his investigation, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Nobles. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim Nobles, legislative auditor. And I know all of you are very familiar with our report. You've heard me present it several times, so I'll be very brief. I think what we found was a failure not only of people, but of structures and of systems. There was clearly a breakdown in the command, in the control, accountability, and oversight for this organization. I think that what we are trying to do here, and legislative action is needed this session because the Metro Gang Strike Force was created in law, what we are trying to do is maintain the strengths and the benefits of having a multi-jurisdictional police force, but put in place structures that will ensure that the kind of abuse and the kind of scandal that occurred won't occur again. And I think that Representative Paymar's bill specifically addresses some of those issues in the various positions, and I will obviously let him explain those, but I'd be happy to answer any questions as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Questions from members? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Nobles, have you testified on Senate File 2725 in the Senate?
Mr. Nobles.
Madam Chair, I have not in the Senate.
Has there been a hearing?
Representative Anderson.
Has there been a hearing on that, Representative Paymar?
Representative Paymar.
What
is it? Representative Anderson.
It's the companion bill on the Senate.
Representative Paymar, it is the Senate companion bill to your bill, I guess. Representative Paymar.
Madam Chair, I don't really know what the status of it is over there, actually. Senator Moore had the bill, but I don't know what it looks like or still looks like the way my bill is.
So, Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, you don't know if it's been heard or been moving, or you don't know where it is as far as what's going to happen. I mean, are you, if it's not moving on the Senate, where's this bill going to go?
Representative Paymar.
Madam Chair, I think it's had a hearing in the Senate. I just don't know where it is right now.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you.
Further questions from members?
Madam Chair, I just wanted
Representative
to
Paymar.
I apologize to the committee for not having my amendments in order now, but I want to tell you what they are, just so you know that this bill is moving ahead. That's going to the Finance Committee. The Chiefs Police Association, the sheriffs would like a larger composition of Minneapolis, St. Paul, Ramsey, and Hennepin County to be part of the Violent Crime Coordinating Council. So we will be adding those members, and they had some concerns about having public defenders on the council, so we will be removing them. The only other thing I wanted to say is that the county attorneys had some concerns about Subdivision 11, and I will be working with them. They were concerned about their role in having to train Strike Force
law enforcement officer to the extent that they believe is listed here, but I there's some language that they feel comfortable with that I did not have in an amendment at this point, but I wanted you to see what the policy changes were, and then we'll do this through the picture and find out if you are questioning member of.
Thank you, Representative Kamer. Are there any other amendments that you intend to offer, Representative Kamer?
No, the only final one would you know, that we may have to, I still believe that the advisory board should be ended, but, you know, we may, I want to meet with all the stakeholders before it gets to this final resting place, and so we may have to delete Section 2 on page 5, but... which is the current advisory board to the Metro Game Circle. Other than that, basically the bill, and we amended in the last committee, in the Simplicious Committee, we took out the issues related to databases that were somewhat controversial. I think we have some agreement on that, but that will be coming along as a separate bill. And then we don't have anything in here relative to forfeiture and stat and the seizure, which is also traveling separately.
Questions from members? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Paymont, besides the membership out here, do you have other individuals from other counties within the 7-county metro that are going to be a part of this?
Representative Paymont.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, there'll be two chiefs of police selected by the, if you look on page online, 119, two chiefs of police selected by the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. One must work in the 7-county metropolitan area, and one must work in greater Minnesota, and then similarly with the two sheriffs. So that's the way the current language is, and then as I stated, deference to the two largest counties that have probably the two for the same problem, Ramsey and Hennepin County, we will be adding those representatives in the next committee.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Paymer, what have you had input from the other counties, Anoka, Dakota, other counties regarding your bill and their concerns for your setting up this council?
Representative Paymer.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, the council is basically the same council as existed before. It used to be called the Gang and Drug Oversight Council, but there was concern that it was a 35-member council that was concerned by the department and others that it was too unwieldy having that many members on there, so we shrunk it. But I haven't heard of anybody else besides the sheriffs in Ramsey and Hennepin and the chiefs in Minneapolis and St. Paul who have a problem with that.
I have Representative Mullery, Representative Bigham, and Representative Druskowski. So, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I don't see any people that probably can answer the question in the room right now. I was told by a couple of law enforcement that Subdivision 8, that there's certain types of property being seized that could not follow the normal procedures for evidence, and I don't know the answer to that, so unfortunately there's nobody from the prosecutor's office. And I don't know if Representative Olin ever had forfeitures in, up there, or whether that, and I see the county attorney's law left.
Representative
Paymer. I think this is pretty basic, the language here, that most, I think all departments have standard procedures for handling these property. And that's also in the,
Representative Paymer, the commissioner's back there. He said that he may have a comment if you'd like to phone a friend. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Sir, Michael Camping, Commissioner of Public Safety. I'm not quite sure I heard the question.
question to Mr. Representative Mullery. I had about departments following
what, Madam Chair.
Representative Mullery.
My question was whether Subdivision 8 here could be true of all seized property in forfeiture. I was told that some types of seized property wouldn't fit within the normal process for handling evidence.
Commissioner.
I don't see difficulties with all of you all. I'm not aware of any difficulties in the seizure of anything that would have.
Okay. But we just sent somebody to see if the county attorneys are around still as well. So, and then, Representative Mullery, do you have other questions? Otherwise, we'll get to Representative Begum and Druskowski first. Okay, Representative Begum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know Representative Paymer will hear more about the funding mechanisms that some of this talks about here in your committee. But is the current law about the role of the Attorney General in there, Subdivision 13 and 14? Is that how we currently operate as a council?
Representative Paymer.
Yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair, we do have a little. Mr. Nobles, I guess, while we're
waiting. Mr. Nobles.
But, Madam Chair and members, I guess I would only point out on the evidence handling, if we read that section,
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
If we want to address again evidence handling in Subdivision 8, a multi jurisdictional entity established pursuant to this section shall process all evidence through the standard evidence handling procedures established by the participating agency. So if you think about that, I mean, what this multi jurisdictional entity is doing, what many other police departments do all the time, they also engage in the same kind of investigative police activity that results in seizing cars, cash, guns, drugs, jewelry. I don't know what this multi-jurisdictional entity would be seizing that would not be in the normal police activity of any one of the participating entities. So,
Representative Mullery.
I don't want to get hung up on this. We can figure this out later.
Okay. Well, Representative Paymer, I just wanted to comment that typically joint powers things do go to local government. You're lucky they've said they don't need to see this. And typically attorney general items go to state government finance. So as long as you're not making any changes, you're probably going to be just fine. But in the event that you are, just so you know, the deadline is Friday, Representative Paymer. So,
well, Madam Chair, for the record, I talked to Chair Pulaski, he did not want to hear the bill.
Okay. You might want to talk to Representative Kahn as well about the other provisions if it isn't current law. Representative Paymer.
Madam Chair.
Representative Begum.
That's not, I mean, I just wasn't, I guess, I was asking not just because of the committee structure about the Attorney General, but it just seems that you're shrinking the task force down and recreating it, and are you taking away any of their, I guess I'm having a hard time understanding if it's current how we do it, then how are we fixing the problems that we had with it? I guess I'm struggling that way.
Mr. Nobles.
Madam Chair and Representative Bingham. Well, one of the things that's significantly different is the authority that's given to the Commissioner of Public Safety, not to the council itself, but as Representative Paymer can certainly explain. When problems occurred with the Metro Gang Strike Force, it was not really clear what the authority of the Commissioner of Public Safety was, other than to simply cut off the money. In this bill, there is a process by which the Commissioner has authority to certify these multi-jurisdictional police entities that receive state money, and he can withdraw that certification and essentially has the authority clearly established, at least in this bill, to abolish them. And there's other authority there as well that is significantly different, I would say, than what existed before in terms of state control.
Okay. Representative Paymer, I guess I do have a question as well. So if the commissioner has the ability to abolish them, say you have a commissioner, different governor, who decides they don't like drug task force and they only like gang task forces, do they have to have a cause to decertify or can they just decertify at a whim? Representative Paymer? You can look and let me know that later, but...
This is an open book test, Representative Paymer.
We'll go on to Representative Druskowski's question while you look into that. Representative Druskowski's question. Ms. Perius.
Madam Chair and representatives, if you look at 318, it states that an entity may not operate unless they meet the guidelines established by and are annually certified by the Commissioner of Public Safety, and then some of the guidelines are outlined from 312 to 317, and so, I mean, there is some guidance in here for the Commissioner.
Great. Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and part of my question may have been answered, but I'm kind of looking for the 30,000-foot view, too, and how this is going to relate to, say, the rural counties in Minnesota, and I think that was part of the answer there, is that there is going to be some oversight of those multi-jurisdictional functions by this coordinating board or coordinating council. Is that right, Representative Paymer?
Representative Paymer.
Chair, that is correct. It's... You know, in actually, the original council that was established still exists. We changed the name. The department wanted the name changed, and also to expand a little bit about the kinds of investigations that happen. So it's more than just gang and drugs, but other violent crimes. So the council still exists. Their oversight function still exists. Their requirements to establish a manual on how these gang and drug strike forces, or now they'll be called, what are they called now? Violent offender. I can't remember what the new name is, what they are.
Violent crime enforcement teams.
Violent crime enforcement teams. So they will establish the guidelines, the procedures, et cetera, much like they currently do. What this does, as Mr. Nobles just said, is it adds an additional layer of accountability, whereas the council and the advisory board, if you look at the Metro Gang Strike Force, was essentially impotent, or the administration was essentially impotent to close it down when there were problems. So this adds an extra layer of accountability, and really, and I know that the department probably doesn't relish the additional oversight as much as I want them to, but we have to have something in place if this kind of situation occurs again. So I don't see, like, if you have one in your jurisdiction, for instance, I don't see this being problematic of following all of the procedures and being certified by the commissioner. And having the necessary audits that take place, I don't see this as being overly cumbersome.
Madam Chair, just...
Representative Druskowski.
Quick follow-up. So, Representative Paymer, it will... I mean, are there additional mandates that are going to happen on our local folks in rural Minnesota? And are they going to still generally have their autonomy to operate? And it sounded like they were supportive, is what I thought I heard earlier. Is that correct?
Representative Paymer.
Madam Chair, Representative Druskowski, the only additional thing here, and then this is one thing that we do have to work out when it gets to finance, would be the auditing of these task forces. And trying to find exactly where that is in the bill here.
That's
the only thing we need. That's why there'll be fiscal notes, and we will determine if there's any additional costs here. And if there is, we're assuming that will be paid out of their grant money that they currently get from the Office of Justice Programs that allows them to exist, which I think is about $6 million for the biennium, if I'm not mistaken.
Madam Chair, real quick.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thanks, Representative Paymos. Are there any other mandates out of here other than that audit? That's the only one we can really find. Anything that additional, I mean, our local folks are going to be saying, you know, what kind of, what are you doing to us today?
Representative Paymar.
Madam Chair, I don't believe that there are any more mandates. They, in fact, I would hazard to guess that probably most of the gang and drug strike forces out there are following all these procedures right now. Because it's Mr. Noblestown and Mr. Lugertown, most of them are housed within a single law enforcement agency, which would require professional policies and procedures for law enforcement. The problem with the Metro Gang Strike Force is that it's sort of an entity onto itself, and you had all of this acrimony with this management board that was responsible for this organization, and while the alleged wrongdoings occurred, the board didn't do anything. So I don't believe that there are additional mandates here in this bill.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Paymar, do you feel, or does the Commissioner feel, that this proposal now is going to resolve the, you know, the concerns that we had here, where there was almost like different entities within the metro area that were not really abiding by what the gang force, strike force, were going with, and it's almost like they had a turf issue. Don't come into my area because we can handle it ourselves. We'll do it on our terms. Do you think this is going to resolve it, or do you think there's still an animosity or a turf issue that's still out there that this is going to take some time?
Representative Paymar or Commissioner? Commissioner's coming.
Well,
Representative Paymar?
Let the Commissioner take a stab at it, but this does not recreate the Metro Gang Strike Force.
Why, no, it doesn't.
Representative. Commissioner.
Madam Chair, it's me again. Representative Anderson, I think the answer to the question is yes. I would add one more thing, Madam Chair, that hasn't been talked about. The other significant piece in this bill that I think is important is the role of the prosecutor. It's designated that the prosecutor has very certain responsibilities. That wasn't the case in the past. It wasn't the case in Greater Minnesota, but now county attorneys, and they have agreed to this, and a lot of discussions, are going to play a much more prominent role on the accountability and oversight on the local level. That's going to be very important, Madam Chair.
Further questions? Seeing none, Representative Paymar renews his motion that House File 2965, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion approved. Representative Mullery.
No.
There are two bills to go. Members, just an announcement. We scheduled a hearing for tomorrow to deal with the gang strike force issues. However, we did not get one of the bills. So we are waiting to see, based on the closing of one of the staff nonpartisan offices, we did not get the bill that we have on our agenda for tomorrow night. So we haven't figured out what we're going to do about that yet. So please remain posted. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Mullery, it's my understanding that this needs to go to State and Local Government Operations Reform and Elections Technology Committee. Okay, Representative Mullery moves House File 3131 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations Reform, Elections, and Technology. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Roseanne Bush. I'm the Deputy Compact Administrator for the Minnesota Department of Corrections. Interstate compact on juveniles is what allows us to transfer the supervision of juveniles between states, and it also allows us to return juvenile runaways, escapees, and absconders between the states. Currently in Minnesota, the compact we belong to is Minnesota Statute 260.51, and this compact was originally passed back in 1957. Since that time, there's been a lot of changes with juveniles, and as a result, states have passed new amendments, and not every state has passed the same amendment. So it resulted in we were no longer functioning as one consistent compact. So there was a movement to rewrite the compact, and they needed 35 states to pass that compact. that happened between 2003 and 2005. Currently, there are 41 states that have signed on to this new compact. But we have the bill 3131 would place Minnesota as a member into that compact. It's the framework for the compact. It establishes a national commission, which oversees the operations of the interstate compact. That commission has rule-making authority, enforcement, and compliance, and it's comprised of one commissioner from every state. This language also establishes how the representative from Minnesota would be appointed. This new language outlines the duties and responsibilities of new member states. It provides for an automatic tracking system of juveniles transferring and returning under the compact. And it establishes a state advisory council, very similar to the adult state council that we currently have functioning in Minnesota. And that council has not only been a benefit to the state of Minnesota, it's also been a benefit on the national level, because some of the current rules that we function under contain language that was submitted by the Minnesota State Advisory Council. It's important that Minnesota become a member of this new compact so we can be involved as this new compact moves forward in the rulemaking process.
Thank you. Questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Mullery renews his motion that House File 3131 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations Reform, Elections, and Technology. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Representative Mullery moves that House File 3381 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Committee. Representative Mullery, this is the last bill on the agenda.
They were finding out that sometimes the prosecution hadn't occurred within 6 months, and so records had been destroyed, DNA that was destroyed, they had to go and retake phones, retake samples, different things like that. So now they're asking that those records be held 1 year because of that problem.
Questions from members? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mullery, do you have a Senate campaign for this bill?
Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, it seems like two inputs here from the department. It's a department bill, so they'll get the Senate.
Representative Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd just like to hear from the department to hear.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Katie Angler, currently on assignment at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. When I checked yesterday, there was not yet a Senate companion for this bill. It is, just to narrow the focus a little bit for you, it's about arrest records for juveniles. And allowing us to keep these for a year will help us to reduce the suspense that we have. I was able to determine since the division hearing on Friday that we estimated there would be a reduction of about a third in the number of arrests that would not have, that, well, we wouldn't be able to match the dispositions to the arrest records in their criminal history. And we hope that by keeping the record longer, we could further reduce that problem.
Questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Mullery renews his motion that House File 3381 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Members, we need a motion to approve the minutes.
So moved.
Representative Lesh moves to approve the minutes of 3-4. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. This meeting is adjourned.